Ephrathon, two homemade bombs exploded at the finish line, killing 3 people and injuring almost 300, including 16 survivors who lost arms or legs. Amid all the confusion, the perpetrators of the attack walked away unscathed. By 2011, the ODNI had established domestic DNI representatives within the United States, similar to the intelligence leads abroad who maintain cognizance of all intelligence activities occurring in their country or field of influence. The 12 regional domestic DNI reps were senior FBI assistant directors or special agents in charge of field offices, and the representative with purview over the New England area was based in Boston. He immediately tapped resources in the National Counterterrorism Center, the DOD agencies, and CIA, as well as all the Justice Department resources available to the FBI. Within 24 hours, the IC had determined that no international terrorist network was involved, and no groundwork had been laid for successive attacks. On April 18th, the FBI released pictures of 2 brothers who had been seen by witnesses and caught on security cameras, carrying and setting down the bags that had contained the homemade bombs. In the massive manhunt over the next 2 days, the brothers shot and killed a police officer, stole a car, and took a hostage. The hostage escaped, and large sections of Boston were placed on lockdown. The brothers, cornered, engaged in a violent gun battle with Boston police. Making his escape, the younger of the two, 19-year-old Zohar Tsarnaev, ran over his wounded older brother, 26-year-old Tamerlane Tsarnaev, with a stolen car. Tamerlane died, and Zohar was later found hiding in a boat in a local backyard. He was wounded in the resulting confrontation and was finally taken into custody, ending the crisis. In many ways, this incident was a nightmare scenario for U.S. intelligence. 2 brothers had emigrated to the United States as minors in 2002, one a citizen, the other's citizenship application pending, had found instructions for making homemade bombs out of common kitchen pressure cookers in the online magazine Inspire, published by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. They weren't in contact with AQAP or other international terrorist organizations and had come up with their plot for indiscriminate slaughter on their own. They had made no phone or email communication that we could have intercepted, and there was no human source whom we could have exploited to learn of and thwart their plan. In fact, this was one of the few prominent times I can remember NSA's using the Patriot Act Section 215 authorities that Senator Wyden had intended to ask me about and was later so critical of. We plugged the brothers' phone numbers into the database to see if they had placed or received international phone calls or if there was a pattern in their calls that would indicate a broader conspiracy to commit further acts of terror. If there had been, we would have had to quickly obtain warrants to find out whom they were talking to and what was said. Fortunately, we determined there was no coordinated plan for further bombings, so in this case, Section 215 didn't enable us to prevent an attack, but did reassure us there was no broader conspiracy involved, which allowed us to focus on finding and apprehending the brothers. We learned that the FBI had interviewed Tamerlane in 2011, 2 years before the bombing, but had concluded he wasn't a threat at the time. When that fact was made public, the FBI and IC were excoriated in the press for not more aggressively surveilling the brothers. After Jim Comey became FBI director 5 months later, he would lament that this unfair criticism meant that the FBI was no longer merely being held to the standard of finding a needle in a haystack, but instead to being able to identify a strand of hay that might one day become a needle. In the weeks after the attack, I felt the practical frustration that Jim would later give eloquent voice to. Even more strongly than frustration, I felt the philosophical conflict in which we were embroiled, as the public, media, and Congress chastised us for not having monitored Tamerlane's internet usage after he had been cleared by the FBI. It was the same feeling I'd had after the Fort Hood shooting, when Congress had asked why we weren't reading Nidal Hassan's emails. Technically, we could do so. It would have required a significant investment in technology and massive changes to U.S. law to allow the intelligence community to get intrusive with the personal business of Americans, but it was feasible. However, I didn't think that's what the U.S. electorate wanted. And moreover, using the U.S. intelligence apparatus to look inward at Americans would require us to override what I believed was an inherent right to privacy, implied if not explicitly stated in the Constitution and Bill of Rights. Some ODNI senior staff members recall us breaking out pocket editions of the Constitution after the Boston Marathon, going right to the source. I don't specifically remember doing that, but it does comport with the kinds of discussions I remember having. But in the spring and summer of 2013, not even questions as fundamental as balancing national security with inherent civil liberties could be my dominant focus for long. On Tuesday, May 14th, DOD announced its final sequestration plan. It would furlough its civilian employees without pay for 11 days over the following 22 weeks. Certain employees would be exempted from this mandatory furlough, for instance, those deployed to war zones and intelligence employees whose jobs were funded by the National Intelligence Program, as determined by the DNI. I think it's a measure of just how personally employees took this announcement that within weeks, job listings in the IC clearly indicated whether the position was NIP-funded or MIP-funded. I even saw one advertisement describing how to make a career in the NIP. I laughed, but I also understood the sentiment that inspired it. Suddenly, and somewhat embarrassingly, I was unofficially declared a hero for the IC workforce. Coincidentally, that same day, legendary Marine Corps General Jim Mattis visited Liberty Crossing. He had just retired from active duty on March 22nd, ending his career as Commander, U.S. Central Command, a position in which he'd overseen operations throughout the combat theater and all the nations affected by the Arab Spring for the previous 2.5 years. After Jim and I had lunch, he addressed the ODNI and IC workforce for an hour of remarks and spirited conversation. He opened by observing that he was delivering his first-ever speech in a suit instead of a uniform. He said that he'd chosen to speak to the intelligence community as his first audience after his retirement because he owed a great debt to its practitioners, and a Marine never forgets his debts. I felt a lot of pride for our community that day, and in my connection to both the intelligence community and the Marine Corps. It felt as if we had more positive energy flowing than we'd had in quite a while. I knew that budgets would continue to be cut, but we now had a clearer vision and a plan for how to compensate. I hoped that the month of May would mark a turning point for IC Fortunes, and that we could refocus on our mission without all the distractions that had plagued us for the last few years. Chapter 8. Snowden. The same week that DOD announced it would not furlough NIP-funded employees, an IT administrator on contract at the large and very important NSA facility in Hawaii told his supervisor he was taking medical leave to fly to the U.S. mainland for treatment. Edward Snowden gave a completely different story to his girlfriend, with whom he shared a home, explaining that he would be away for a few weeks and couldn't say where he was going, conveying the implication that he was off on a secret mission for NSA. On Monday, May 20th, 2013, he flew to Hong Kong, carrying a bag of laptops holding hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, as we had no idea of the actual number at the time and still aren't certain, of intelligence documents and communications, many not just classified but compartmented to protect sensitive sources. Cleared employees are read into compartmented programs only when they have a need to know about them. Tapping into what he thought he knew about maintaining cover, he checked into a plush hotel and began subsisting on room service. Over the next 2 weeks, as Snowden divulged gravely damaging secrets about how the U.S. intelligence community operates, he wrapped his every action in mystery using signals and secret code phrases to rendezvous with reporters and give them his stolen information. If we had been looking for him, I believe we would have found him. But we weren't. Snowden's lies to his supervisor and girlfriend were credible enough that neither questioned them, and so the U.S. intelligence community was blissfully unaware that, in an exotic port city of mainland China, we were hemorrhaging intelligence capabilities through a trusted insider turned traitor. Looking back, there's a coincidental timing to all of this that makes our naivete in not preparing for the possibility of insider treachery and actively monitoring for it inexcusable. On June 3rd in Washington, D.C., literally as Edward Snowden was meeting with two reporters and a documentary filmmaker in Hong Kong, the military trial of Private First Class Bradley Manning was getting underway. We knew Manning was a transgender woman in June 2013, but she didn't become Private Chelsea Manning until after her sentencing in August. Manning had been a low-level intelligence analyst in Iraq from late 2009 into 2010, when she became disenchanted with intelligence reports she was reading, which she felt showed a moral ambiguity not apparent in the public narrative of the war. She felt obligated to reveal that prisoner abuses were still taking place nearly 6 years after the Abu Ghraib scandal, and she was disturbed by combat reports and video that indicated that U.S. soldiers, some of whom had deployed on repeated combat tours, had a casual attitude toward killing. For Manning, the line defining which side was in the right had blurred until it ceased to exist. Envisioning it a form of citizen activism, she swept up all the classified and sensitive materials she could acquire, 500,000 military documents and 250,000 diplomatic cables, and gave them to the online organization WikiLeaks in January 2010. This single massive theft and release made everything else WikiLeaks had published, combined, pale by comparison. On April 5, 2010, at the National Press Club in Washington, WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange released the most incendiary material he'd received from Manning, a gunsight video from an Apache helicopter, complete with the audio from its radio transmissions and cockpit internal communications circuit. The video showed the gunship firing on a gathering of men on a town square in New Baghdad, Iraq, on July 12, 2007. Later in the video, the Apache fires again, this time on a van that pulls up to the scene, after its occupants get out and begin to move casualties. What differentiated this footage from other combat videos is that during the series of firefights, two Iraqi correspondents who were covering the war for Reuters were killed, and two children who were in the van were injured and later evacuated by U.S. troops. DOD had shown the video to Reuters soon after the incident occurred, but hadn't released it publicly, despite Reuters having filed a Freedom of Information Act request. With that information as the backdrop, Assange staged the April 5th event as a way of announcing that his organization could and would publish leaked materials that governments did not want released. He pitched WikiLeaks as an organization with no agenda other than shining a bright light into the dark places that powerful governments and international organizations didn't want the world to see. In fact, WikiLeaks did have an agenda, which was apparent in its editorial choices even at that early point. The video opens with a quote from George Orwell, white letters on a black screen. "Political language is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable, and to give the appearance of solidity to pure wind." Over ominous garbled voices and clicks and buzzes of military radio microphones being keyed, the screen cuts to a title card reading "Collateral Murder," with a website address www.collateralmurder.com. The video then provides this context. On the morning of July 12, 2007, two Apache helicopters using 30-millimeter cannon fire killed about a dozen people in the Iraqi suburb of New Baghdad. Two children were also wounded. Although some of the men appear to have been armed, the behavior of nearly everyone was relaxed. the U.S. military initially claimed that all the dead were anti-Iraqi forces or insurgents. The stories of most of those who were killed are unknown, but among the dead were two Reuters News employees, Saeed Shamag and Namir Nur el-Din. The footage cuts to photographs of the deceased Reuters correspondents and of their families in anguish, interspersed with quotes from friends and co-workers. It then cuts to a black screen with the words, "The U.S. military claimed the victims died in a battle that took place between U.S. forces and insurgents." There is no question that coalition forces were clearly engaged in combat operations against a hostile force. Lieutenant Colonel Scott Blightwell, spokesman for U.S. forces in Baghdad, New York Times. The implication of the introduction, running 2 minutes and 46 seconds in a video with a total runtime of 17 minutes and 46 seconds, was unmistakable. WikiLeaks and Assange intended to demonstrate that the U.S. military was covering up its extreme wrongdoing with lies. After the introduction, the video cuts to the black-and-white gunsight video. As the helicopter crew attempts to discern what's happening in the town square, an arrow inserted by WikiLeaks points to Saeed with camera. And as one of the pilots says on the internal circuit, "That's a weapon," another arrow identifies Namir with camera. A moment later, the pilot says, "He's got a weapon too." No arrow appears to identify another man holding an AK-47, nor the man holding an RPG, a rocket-propelled grenade. The helicopter crew requests and receives permission to engage, and the ensuing fire kills or disables everyone on screen. Arrows identify Namir's body and Saeed trying to escape. The video fades out and back in. On the internal cockpit circuit, the pilot handling the flight controls congratulates the pilot who had done the shooting, and they discuss the incident in a manner indicating they are comfortable with what had just occurred. The pilots acknowledge one person as still being alive, which a WikiLeaks inserted arrow indicates is Saeed. Once the pilots identify him as being disabled and unarmed, they report on the radio that they will hold fire, but they keep the helicopter's gun trained on the wounded man. On the internal circuit, one is heard saying, "Come on, buddy, all you got to do is pick up a weapon." The helicopter continues to circle as a van pulls up near the wounded man, and one pilot transmits, "We have individuals going to the scene, looks like possibly picking up bodies and weapons." As the van drivers carry Saeed, the pilots repeatedly request permission to engage. Finally, given the go-ahead, they fire on the van. When they cease firing, an arrow identifies Saeed's body, and the video cuts to a black screen reading, "8 minutes after the attack, ground troops arrive on the scene." "We pulled up and stopped, and I could hear them over the intercom say they couldn't drive the Bradleys, tanks, in because there were too many bodies and didn't want to drive over them." Captain James Hall, Army Chaplain, Washington Post. The remainder of the video shows a Humvee driving over a body as it arrives on scene, to the apparent amusement of the pilots, fades out and then cuts to soldiers pulling the two wounded children from the van and running with them in their arms. After several moments, one pilot is heard on the internal circuit saying, "Well, it's their fault for bringing their kids into a battle." The other replies, "That's right." I believe the early parts of this video could prompt Americans to contemplate and discuss how years of war have produced a generation of soldiers who were callous about inflicting death. However, the selective editing and editorializing done by WikiLeaks encouraged a different narrative, one that seemed to recall the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. In 1968, an angry U.S. Army platoon entered a Vietnamese village and wiped it out, killing 347 men, women, and children indiscriminately. The massacre was a monumental turning point for the American public tolerance for the Southeast Asia War. But New Baghdad was not My Lai. The Apache pilots may have been more comfortable with taking life than we'd like, but they were not indiscriminate killers. This would have been more apparent if the context inserted by WikiLeaks had made any attempt to portray the military perspective. At no point does the collateral murder video indicate that the AH-64 Apaches were providing cover ahead of the troops in Humvees and on foot who are shown at the end of the video. Soldiers who, just before the video begins, had been attacked by insurgents with AK-47s and RPGs just a few miles down the road. And what the video revealed, at least to my ears, is the shift in tone in the final lines of dialogue between the pilots. When the pilot manning the guns blames the children's injuries on the men who'd driven the kids into a firefight, I hear, as I've heard in many similar circumstances, a service member taking his first steps toward trying to live with the reality of an action carried out in battle, something he already regrets. The video quickly became a sensation in the media and online. Along with continued publication of the documents provided by Manning, it and the April 5th release event put WikiLeaks on the map and brought the idea of activism through massive leaks into the public consciousness as a means of ostensibly making political statements. Assange was elevated in the press to celebrity status, and he traveled the world promoting himself and his organization, as Manning remained anonymous. 6 weeks later, in an online chat on May 20th, Manning revealed to semi-famous former hacker Adrian Lamo that she was WikiLeaks' source. Lamo contacted the FBI, and on May 27, 2010, the Army Criminal Investigation Command arrested Manning. Before Manning's apprehension, WikiLeaks had been releasing small caches of classified and sensitive U.S. documents onto the Internet, appearing at least not to intend to put lives in danger, although not taking sufficient care to actually accomplish that goal. After Manning's arrest, Assange seemed intent on dumping as many classified documents onto the Internet as he could, as quickly as he could. In my last few months as USDI, and my first few months as DNI, on top of dealing with the confirmation process and starting work as the fourth DNI in 5 years, my time and attention were also taken up by the efforts at DOD and CIA to deal with these document dumps. Teams were on standby in both places to sort quickly through whatever was exposed in an effort to find names and identifying details for people in Iraq and Afghanistan who were helping the U.S. war effort, and then to try to rescue them before the Taliban or Iraqi insurgents could find and kill them. In the midst of this, some young action officer with a sense of humor snuck an in-joke past CIA leaders, calling the CIA team the WikiLeaks Task Force, abbreviated as WTF. Then Julian Assange made a personal mistake. In August, two women in Sweden alleged to police that in separate incidents, what had started as consensual sex became non-consensual, and in both instances, Assange didn't stop. Sweden issued an arrest warrant, and in December, Assange turned himself in to British police. His attorneys fought extradition for the next year and a half, but in May 2012, the British Supreme Court ruled that the Swedish extradition order was valid. In disguise as a delivery man, Assange snuck into the Ecuadorian embassy in London, claiming that he was the victim of a U.S.-led conspiracy to get him to Sweden, where the CIA could whisk him away to stand trial for political crimes in the United States. In fact, the U.S. justice system doesn't work that way, and the United Kingdom, where Assange was living, was our closest partner for both military and intelligence operations, while Sweden was more likely to resist if the United States asked for Assange. The Ecuadorian embassy granted him asylum, and he took up permanent residence there, fearful that leaving it would lead to his immediate arrest. The result of this bizarre series of events is that the director of WikiLeaks hasn't set foot outside the Ecuadorian embassy since May 2012. Grotesquely, to me, much of the international media glamorized him, establishing a new archetype of long-suffering leaker activist under self-imposed house arrest for others to follow. I'm in agreement with CIA Director Mike Pompeo's 2017 characterization of WikiLeaks as a non-state hostile intelligence service. In December 2012, at the very time I was trying to explain to lawmakers on Capitol Hill why intelligence collection under Section 702 of FISA was so important to security. Edward Snowden sent encrypted emails to Glenn Greenwald, a reporter for the UK daily newspaper The Guardian, holding out the offer of classified documents that he claimed revealed NSA spying on U.S. citizens. According to Greenwald, Snowden's first approach to him was so wrapped in code names and backdoor communications channels that he initially didn't take the offer seriously. Snowden then contacted Laura Poitras, a documentary filmmaker who had been the subject of a feature Greenwald had written in April 2012, and asked her to help him recruit Greenwald. Once she convinced Greenwald to give Snowden an opportunity, they began exchanging encrypted communications, and Snowden transmitted some of the documents he'd stolen. By the time Snowden fled to Hong Kong in May 2013, Julian Assange had been ensconced in the London Ecuadorian embassy for only 11 months. Poitras, Greenwald, and a second reporter for The Guardian, Ewan McCaskill, flew to Hong Kong to meet Edward Snowden. In a piece for the New York Times, Peter Maas somewhat famously captured the cloak-and-dagger feel of that first meeting. Snowden had instructed them that once they were in Hong Kong, they were to go at an appointed time to the Kowloon district and stand outside a restaurant that was in a mall connected to the Mira Hotel. There, they were to wait until they saw a man carrying a Rubik's Cube, then ask him when the restaurant would open. The man would answer their question, then warn that the food was bad. When the man with the Rubik's Cube arrived, it was Edward Snowden. Over the next several days, blocking cracks around doors with blankets and pillows and covering his laptop, Snowden spilled the U.S. government secrets he'd stolen to the two reporters as Poitras recorded the sessions. By each of their accounts, Snowden eventually gave them the massive files of highly classified documents he'd smuggled out of Hawaii. On Wednesday, June 5th, The Guardian published Glenn Greenwald's first story from the Snowden leaks. The article began, "The National Security Agency is currently collecting the telephone records of millions of U.S. customers of Verizon, one of America's largest telecoms providers, under a top-secret court order issued in April. The order, a copy of which has been obtained by The Guardian, requires Verizon on an ongoing daily basis to give the NSA information on all telephone calls in its systems, both within the U.S. and between the U.S. and other countries. The document shows for the first time that under the Obama administration, the communication records of millions of U.S. citizens are being collected indiscriminately and in bulk, regardless of whether they are suspected of any wrongdoing. I've said many times in private, and even a few times publicly, that what transpired next would have played out very differently if, in September 2001, someone, Secretary Rumsfeld, DCI Tenet, or even President Bush, had come out and publicly stated, we need to be able to track whom the terrorists overseas are talking to here in the United States. So we're going to save call records and we're going to treat them like the FBI treats its fingerprint files. We'll hold them in reserve, and if we discover a plot to conduct a terrorist attack, we'll get a warrant to see who the terrorist is communicating with. If someone in authority had announced that, I believe both Congress and most Americans likely would have judged such actions to be reasonable, and we could have had an open discussion about how to execute them while protecting civil liberties. Instead, 7 years after the phrase enhanced interrogation techniques had become part of the public lexicon, and many Americans had begun questioning what their intelligence community was doing in their name, a UK daily paper published a report that we were collecting intelligence indiscriminately and in bulk on millions of Americans. We appeared as if we'd been caught doing something terribly wrong. Greenwald's story also implicated me personally. Near the end of that first article, he wrote, "The court order appears to explain the numerous cryptic public warnings by two U.S. senators, Ron Wyden and Mark Udall, about the scope of the Obama administration's surveillance activities." Very quickly, the Internet dredged up video of the March hearing in which Senator Wyden and I had our exchange, and cable networks began to air it. leaving off Senator Wyden's long and confusing preface about dossiers, which complicated the narrative and didn't fit into a soundbite, the clip merely showed the final back and forth. Does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? No, sir. It does not? Not wittingly. The media narrative immediately solidified into the simple assertion that the DNI had lied to Congress under oath to cover up NSA wrongdoing. Missing from the ensuing discussion were two honestly inconsequential facts. I wasn't under oath at the worldwide threat hearing, and the Guardian story concerned a court order from April after my testimony. I describe these details as inconsequential because at the time I testified, there were other programs collecting metadata under Section 215 authorities, and because I always have an obligation to tell the truth to Congress whether I'm under oath or not. However, the accusation also left out three very consequential details that put my answer into context. First, Senator Wyden had asked me about dossiers on Americans, using that word twice in his question. And dossiers are impossible to build from telephone metadata. Second, my answer, not wittingly, only makes sense in the context of intercepting the communications content of bona fide foreign targets without knowing Americans were on the other end of the line. We absolutely knew we were collecting metadata. We were witting, very aware of that, as was the committee. Third, and foremost in my mind, the accusation held that I had lied to the Senate committee dedicated to oversight of the IC, a committee whose members had access to and already knew the facts about each of the programs in question. My reputation on Capitol Hill was that I consistently spoke truth, often at the expense of politics and propriety. I'd stated, for example, that China and Russia were the greatest threats to U.S. national security, when the State Department and White House really would have preferred I not. I had testified dozens of times over the 2.5 decades since my DIA confirmation in 1991, and I'd never lied and never been accused of lying. But the accusation was that, just this once, for a change of pace, I'd chosen to lie, and I'd done it on live television before the Senate committee, who had both the authority and ability to check my answer immediately, and that I'd done it 10 minutes before a closed, classified hearing at which we could lay out all the details of the programs in question and discuss them freely. Really? I recognize, of course, that this explanation may sound defensive, and as if these accusations bother me a great deal. If I'm going to continue speaking truth, I have to acknowledge that it is, and they do. I'm bothered because, as an intelligence officer, I depend on my customers, which in 2013 included the President and Congress, to take it as a given that I will always speak truth to power. The media members who pressed this narrative that I'd lied sought to undermine that trust. I'm also angered because the narrative was purposefully blind. Later that summer, ODNI Public Affairs Director Sean Turner invited journalists from two national publications separately to discuss the March hearing and why I'd answered the way I did. Both journalists, again separately, gave Sean the same answer. The explanation he gave to them sounded plausible, even believable, but reporting that the DNI lied under oath, sold newspaper copies, and drove internet clicks, and their editors would never let them change that narrative. So in writing that I'd lied, at least some journalistic publications were shirking their own obligation to the truth. In June 2013, however, we had much bigger concerns than my personal reputation. While we couldn't publicly confirm or deny the existence of a top-secret court order forcing Verizon to turn over its call records, after June 5th, our adversaries certainly knew to stop using Verizon for their communications. Then, on June 6th, The Guardian published another article that began, "The National Security Agency has obtained direct access to the systems of Google, Facebook, Apple, and other U.S. internet giants, according to a top-secret document obtained by The Guardian." The NSA access is part of a previously undisclosed program called PRISM, which allows officials to collect material including search history, the content of emails, file transfers, and live chats, the document says. The Guardian has verified the authenticity of the document, a 41-slide PowerPoint presentation classified as top secret with no distribution to foreign allies, which was apparently used to train intelligence operatives on the capabilities of the program. The document claims collection directly from the servers of major U.S. service providers. Although the presentation claims the program is run with the assistance of the companies, all those who responded to a Guardian request for comment on Thursday denied knowledge of any such program. Revealing the existence of PRISM was no longer merely exposing a program that aggregates metadata. PRISM was how we collected content from terrorists, adversarial governments, and hostile intelligence services. This and subsequent articles said PRISM gave us access to email, video, and voice chat, videos, photos, voiceover IP, Skype, for example, chats, file transfers, social networking details, and more. Included in the Guardian's feature were images purported to be PowerPoint slides from NSA marked as top secret and compartmented, which would give our adversaries not only an overview of a powerful U.S. intelligence tool, but also clues as to how to avoid surveillance. Worse, the level of specificity in the article, combined with the fact that the Guardian had published details of disparate classified programs 2 days in a row, and that the Washington Post published its own PRISM story, left no doubt that NSA wasn't just leaking, but had its own version of PFC Manning, one who was disclosing secrets far more dangerous to national security. This riveted the attention of the entire national security enterprise and galvanized our counterintelligence and security apparatus to identify and locate the traitor. The Washington Post, at least, ran an acknowledgment a few days after its PRISM article retracting the allegation that NSA had direct access to the company servers. The retraction received almost no notice. On Friday, The Guardian published an article alleging that President Obama had asked the IC to draw up a target list for overseas cyber attacks and included a copy of a purported presidential memo issuing the order. That day, The Washington Post also featured two new pieces from leaked documents. On Saturday, The Guardian published their fourth article. The National Security Agency has developed a powerful tool for recording and analyzing where its intelligence comes from, raising questions about its repeated assurances to Congress that it cannot keep track of all the surveillance it performs on American communications. The Guardian has acquired top-secret documents about the NSA data mining tool, called Boundless Informant, that details and even maps by country the voluminous amount of information it collects from computer and telephone networks. The focus of the internal NSA tool is on counting and categorizing the records of communications, known as metadata, rather than the content of an email or instant message. The Boundless Informant documents show the agency collecting almost 3 billion pieces of intelligence from U.S. computer networks over a 30-day period ending in March 2013. One document says it is designed to give NSA officials answers to questions like, what type of coverage do we have on country X, in near real time by asking the SIGINT infrastructure. Images attached to the article, marked as top secret and compartmented, revealed, not surprisingly, that much of our signals intelligence collection was taking place in active combat zones, but it also indicated that signals intelligence was a global enterprise. However, while the reporters framed this as a revelation that the U.S. intelligence community was spying on poor and irrelevant nations of the world, our more astute adversaries could use the leaked information to discern how we were spying on them, using back doors around the globe. We were hemorrhaging capabilities, and because we didn't know the source of the leaks, we couldn't stop them. Then, on Sunday, The Guardian posted a video filmed by Laura Poitras. After an establishing shot of marine traffic moving about Hong Kong Harbor, the camera cuts to the face of a young man wearing an open-collared shirt and glasses, with mussed hair and a slight, uneven stubble. His head and shoulders fill the right side of the frame, and a mirror reflects the back of his head out of focus. A still frame from this video became the iconic image of Snowden. His Che Guevara t-shirt shot, featured on his Wikipedia page and whenever a story about him runs on TV. He glances at the camera and then away again as he says, "My name's Ed Snowden. I'm 29 years old. I work for Booz Allen Hamilton as an infrastructure analyst for NSA. Over the next 12 minutes, as edited by Poitras, Glenn Greenwald interviews Snowden on camera, describing how Snowden had moved from working at CIA to Dell to Booz Allen Hamilton in a series of information technology-related jobs. Greenwald asks what led Snowden from thinking about being a whistleblower to making the choice to actually become a whistleblower. Snowden answers, "When you're in positions of privileged access, like a systems administrator for these sort of intelligence community agencies, you're exposed to a lot more information on a broader scale than the average employee. And because of that, you see things that may be disturbing, but over the course of a normal person's career, you'd only see one or two of these instances. When you see everything, you see them on a more frequent basis, and you recognize that some of these things are actually abuses. When you talk to people about them in a place like this, where this is the normal state of business, people tend not to take them very seriously and, you know, move on from them. But over time, that awareness of wrongdoing sort of builds up, and you feel compelled to talk about it. And the more you talk about it, the more you're ignored, the more you're told it's not a problem, until eventually you realize that these things need to be determined by the public, not by somebody who was simply hired by the government." His answer was chilling. Here was someone, a kid,
yes, at 72, everyone was a kid to me,
who, like Manning, believed he had unique access, was someone who could see everything. Like Manning, he had appointed himself as judge over what he had seen, and then, without conducting an investigation or calling out wrongdoers, was going to bring about justice in ways that multiple executive branch agencies, Congress and federal courts, which were all aware of and conducted oversight of the very programs that concerned him, apparently were unable or unwilling to do. Unlike Manning, however, Snowden had unique IT accesses and had acted methodically to steal secrets, continuing to collect them for a full 6 months after first communicating with the person to whom he planned to leak, tricking his co-workers into giving him their passwords, even changing to a new job with different accesses to get at other files he wanted to leak. The materials Manning had leaked were embarrassing. The secrets Snowden was releasing were revealing to our adversaries and international terrorist groups how to avoid or thwart our surveillance. By the time the video was published online, Edward Snowden had bid farewell to Greenwald, Poitras, and McCaskill, and gone to ground in Hong Kong with Sarah Harrison, Julian Assange's most trusted aide, and someone who actually knew how to disappear. In Washington and at NSA headquarters in Maryland, the IC scrambled to learn what they could about Edward Snowden. By all accounts, he was a high school dropout who'd later earned a general equivalency diploma and was a capable software engineer. He'd enlisted in the Army and had suffered stress fractures in his legs from unaccustomed exercise during basic training. His Army records indicated that instead of recycling him to a later training class to allow him to heal, they'd simply discharged him. He'd gotten work as a security guard for a publicly acknowledged NSA facility at the University of Maryland in 2005, and then applied for and got an IT job at the CIA. After a 6-month training course in 2006, the CIA stationed him in Europe, where his supervisor and co-workers considered him difficult to deal with. Fearing he was going to be fired because of an incident in 2009, he resigned, listing his girlfriend's health issues as his reason for leaving. And here's where an IC security vulnerability becomes glaringly evident. The CIA hadn't attached any alerts to his background profile, and when Snowden applied to become an NSAIT administrator, contracted through Dell Technologies, NSA supposedly never verified his references. NSA assigned him in Asia, then back to Maryland, and then to Hawaii in March 2012, where he worked on IT systems in the agency's information-sharing office. In that role, he had access to a vast array of NSA systems, programs, and data. In March 2013, he left Dell to work for Booz Allen Hamilton in a similar role, still at NSA Hawaii, and he continued to steal classified material. Because of his frequent job hopping, his employment history was difficult to reconstruct, but by late Monday, we knew where he'd worked and generally what information he'd had access to, and we knew he'd used his system administrator privileges to get to many things he should not have had access to. We learned later that he had begun copying and stealing classified material across multiple systems almost as soon as he arrived in Hawaii in March 2012. Our security programs were not designed to monitor users' electronic behavior across multiple systems and domains, and NSA couldn't distinguish what he'd actually copied and stolen from what he'd merely examined. He'd skirted security safeguards by accessing information through the accounts of co-workers, one of whom lost his job and career for giving his login information to Snowden, who claimed to need it for his system administrator work. Also tellingly, when retracing his steps, NSA found that he'd applied to work in the agency's Tailored Access Operations Office as one of its truly elite hackers. The TAO qualification test is notoriously difficult, as one would expect, and about 50% of applicants fail. Snowden took the test, passed, and was offered a job in TAO as a general schedule government employee, though he believed he should have been graded as a senior executive service officer. SES officers make up less than one-half of 1% of the government workforce, and I don't know of anyone who was promoted to that position in his 20s. He turned the position down, citing his larger salary as a contractor. When reconstructing his steps in 2013, NSA discovered that he had used his IT administrator privileges to access the account of the person in charge of administering the TAO qualification test and had stolen and viewed the test before taking it. Cheating on a test to become a spy is an amusing premise for Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase in Spies Like Us. It's obviously not acceptable in the real world of U.S. intelligence. On Tuesday morning, I entered the Oval Office with a sense of foreboding.
A day and a half after Snowden had been identified publicly, I would have to brief the president on what we knew.
My trepidation wasn't just because the news was bad, but because I simply had so little information to report. In the anteroom outside the Oval, I mentally ran through the questions we didn't have answers for. Was Snowden recruited by or working with a foreign intelligence agency? Did he have help? Where was he in Hong Kong? Why did he go to China? What was he going to do with whatever he took? And most critical, what exactly did he steal? I knew this would be an entirely different truth-to-power moment than I'd ever had in the Oval Office before. This time, I wasn't asserting an intelligence hard fact that went against my principal's worldview,
but instead was about to inform the President of the United States
that we'd potentially had one of the worst thefts of U.S. secrets in the history of intelligence, and that I couldn't tell him much for certain beyond that fact. This wasn't exactly the IC's, or my, finest hour. I could usually tell how an Oval session was going to go by what the president was doing when I arrived. If he was walking around, standing at the credenza by his scheduler's desk, scanning the newspapers, or standing outside the office chatting with the White House staff, it would probably go pleasantly. That morning I found President Obama already in his seat, studying his iPad with a grim look. He didn't glance up when I walked in. Since my days of briefing signals intelligence intercepts of the Viet Cong to General Westmoreland, I've always felt more comfortable having the aid of some sort of graphic depiction as both a memory crutch and a security blanket. For this meeting, I came equipped with printed graphic depictions of all the NSA and IC systems Snowden had had access to, where he'd been stationed in Hawaii, the hotel where he'd first gone in Hong Kong, and the progress of his 7-year IC career. When the president finally looked up, I held out a chart showing Snowden's job-hopping career. As he scanned the graphic, I started to discuss the very little that we knew about Snowden. President Obama held up a hand to stop my talking, glanced over the page one more time, and waved it away too, saying, "We'll get more detail later." There was a pause. I have no idea how long. And then he shook his head, incredulous. Everyone else was very still and silent, trying to avoid being noticed. The president never raised his voice, but turned his frustration on me. "How could you people allow this guy to jump around like this and not see that he was a problem child?" My 50 years of experience, mostly as the junior guy in the room, told me not to answer, just let him vent. He described what he'd seen of this as Bush League. My job was supposed to be getting the agencies to talk to one another, and yet NSA officials had no idea that they were hiring someone the CIA considered problematic and untrustworthy. Worse, that failure had happened on Obama's watch during his first year as president. He'd fumed about all the ways this was going to hurt his relationships with foreign leaders, a ramification I'd certainly considered, and he complained how it was going to distract from and set back other agenda items, like health care, climate change, and legalizing same-sex marriage, just when our nation was making progress, things I hadn't fully considered. He didn't yell. He didn't call me names. But for the 10 minutes or so we had allocated for the intelligence session that morning, he released the steam of his slowly boiling anger at me. I left the Oval that morning feeling like an Omega dog slinking away from a confrontation with the Alpha, not quite sure if he's actually hurt or just feeling that way. We had badly let down the president, and for that matter, the nation. I wanted to disappear into the woodwork. Leaks continued to drip through The Guardian and The Washington Post, and on Thursday, June 13th, Snowden gave an interview to the South China Morning Post, claiming that NSA was hacking computers in Hong Kong and mainland China, and that while he felt the United States was bullying China to extradite him, he had no intention of leaving and would fight extradition in Hong Kong's court system. The following day, the U.S. Justice Department brought formal charges against Snowden under the 1917 Espionage Act, and the U.K. government took steps to prevent him from traveling through their airspace. Perhaps in retaliation, on Sunday, The Guardian dragged the U.K. into the fray with an article saying the GCHQ, their NSA equivalent, had spied on global leaders during the 2009 G20 summit in London. More stories and more leaks spilled out every day. One claimed that the GCHQ tapped fiber-optic cables belonging to the communications companies to gain access to the world's emails, Facebook posts, and internet histories, and that they then shared all of that information with NSA. Another said that the U.S. courts were complicit in enabling NSA to use inadvertent collections against Americans. Many, if not all, but who could keep track of these stories, were inaccurate, misleading, or incomplete in how they characterized intelligence activities. Still, many did reveal vital secrets, and we watched as our intelligence advantage eroded. There wasn't much we could do about the factual errors, as attempting to correct them would mean revealing actual intelligence sources and methods that weren't in the leaks. As I dealt with the fallout within official channels, I was grateful for former intelligence officials like Mike Hayden, who could appear on TV and say things I couldn't say as DNI. On Friday, June 14th, in a conversation with Fareed Zakaria on CNN, Mike laid out how the publication of the leaks was undermining national security. "We've reminded our enemies how good and comprehensive we are at this," We will punish American businesses that have cooperated under U.S. law and at the direction of a U.S. court. This is bound to be bad news for them in terms of their international business. And then finally, globally, a country or a source that might be thinking of cooperating with the United States should have almost no confidence in our discretion or in our ability to keep a secret. Over the next year and more, Mike would be an IC surrogate for many of the difficult conversations to come, including debates about balancing civil liberties protections against security. At several points, he spoke about the metadata program, explaining what it was and wasn't, noting other actions we as citizens take for the common good, like following traffic laws and submitting to searches before boarding planes. He posed the reasonable question, what are we willing to let our intelligence community do in the name of public safety? I didn't consider that to be a rhetorical question, and wished we as a nation could arrive at a reasonable consensus answer. 2 weeks into the deluge of Snowden stories, the entire IC was constantly on edge and on the defensive. We issued statements explaining the procedural steps that prevented NSA analysts from doing the kind of surveillance Snowden said they were engaged in. We published papers discussing how the oversight process involved all three branches of government and how everyone was checking everyone else's work. Those publications were ignored, disregarded, or scoffed at by the skeptical media and by politicians with axes to grind. What bothered me most was that in the public discussion of intelligence, there seemed to be an implicit, nearly universal narrative that the IC's workforce was filled with people scheming to spy on their friends, neighbors, and citizens at large. That story simply did not describe the intelligence community people or mission I knew and believed in. The fact that we had neither the inclination, authority, nor resources to actually do what we'd been accused of didn't seem to matter. IC service starts with swearing an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, the same oath the military takes. Intelligence officers of all types have the same dedication to public service that our uniformed troops do, and they make the same sort of sacrifices. IC people do shift work, keeping watch through the night. They toil long hours, staying until the job is done, because they can't bring classified material home to finish after dinner or bedtime stories. And when they do get home, they don't get parades, and they aren't able to boast to their parents or children, "I did that. I made this research breakthrough, I brokered a partnering agreement with a foreign power, or I broke up this terrorist plot." IC service means toiling in anonymity and not getting public recognition for achievements. It means accepting less pay to serve. And for many members of the IC in the summer of 2013, it meant enduring government-mandated furloughs and trying to pay bills with 10% less income. Intelligence officers deploy to dangerous places, away from their families. Some lose their lives, and some of them will never have their sacrifice publicly acknowledged, even in death. In the lobby of CIA headquarters, 125 stars are carved into the white marble wall, one for each CIA officer who died in service. In the book at the base of the wall, only 91 names are listed. The other 34 stars have no names associated with them because public disclosure of the officers who lost their lives or public discussion of their missions would mean revealing national security secrets. NSA has a similar display honoring an even greater number of people who've paid the ultimate price. Those officers knew what their sacred trust meant when they took on the missions that cost their lives. And in June 2013, one of their own, a former CIA employee who became a contractor with NSA, had betrayed that trust and revealed many damaging secrets about how the IC did its job. On June 21st, for the first time, we took the extraordinary step of declassifying a major program, the metadata storage governed by Section 215 of the Patriot Act. Snowden had made public the mechanics of how the program worked, and the media had run with the story, stating as fact that anything IC employees physically could do with this program, and honestly, many things we physically couldn't do, we were doing. In declassifying it, we went to great lengths to defend its utility. Looking back, it was a mistake to oversell Section 215. At one point, NSA asserted that its authorities had led to the disruption of 50 terrorist plots, when in fact those plots turned out to have been thwarted through a combination of surveillance authorities. Section 215 was actually a rarely used safety net, but one we were reluctant